I was so prepared to talk randomly about stuff that you all wouldn't necessarily know about, and then Naomi's fifth grade classmate's mom is sitting here, and she's probably heard half of this already. So thank you for being here. And I've been told by several people that this morning's sermon had a little bit about Naomi and a lot about the walkout next door that some of our kids participated in and led, and about how your pastor decided, made the choice that he had work to do and that he couldn't go and that he regretted it. And so I want to thank you for being here because you don't need to be. And I want to thank you for being here because there's probably few issues that are more difficult for people to talk about than race. I have found in the last 10 years of being the only white person in my nuclear family that it is a necessary conversation that is really, truly difficult for people to have. And I was thinking again to myself this morning that what qualifies me to even have this conversation? I'm not a PhD. I'm barely a bachelor's of science, hardly qualified for much, except, you know, maybe raising a little money for Fred here and there. But it's been an interesting and difficult ride being the mother of two black children for the last 10 years. And it's taught me a lot. And what it has taught me most of all is that it is important as a white woman to sit in front of a room full of predominantly white people to have this conversation. And your willingness to do it allows you to put a bit of your privilege aside to join your neighbors and your community to make the world a better place. So thank you for being here this morning. Race, you know, as I said, is a difficult topic to talk about, and I often find in leading these workshops, it's like talking to my grandmother when she would talk about the neighbor who has cancer. She'd be like, "Oh, you know Betty, I saw Betty last week." And people do the same thing about race. I will tell you, raising two black children and living with a black man, they know they're black. It is not a surprise to them. It is not a surprise to, you know, those of you who know my 11-year-old, you know this to be true. Since she could talk, she would be the first person to say, "Hey, you know, I'm the only black person in this room," right? And I find myself on rare occasion being the only white person in the room and thinking to myself, "Wow, I'm the only white person in this room, and that's weird," right? It's not bad, it's not good, it's just weird. And you stop and you realize that a good amount of the black people you know who work with you or who live next door, that's a way of life for people. So when we talk about race and we talk about the fact that we are white people talking about a very difficult conversation, we have a tendency to say things like, "Oh, I'm colorblind. Race doesn't matter to me." Or, "We now live in a post-racial society where race doesn't really matter." So I'm here to dissuade you of those two notions. Because while we all like to be blind to each other's differences, and we raise our kids, right? "Shh, don't look at that child over there in the wheelchair. Don't point out the fact that somebody is differently abled." Or, you know, "Don't mention the fact that that child is a different color." It does your child no good, and it does my child no good to do that. Because, again, my 11-year-old and my 9-year-old, since they're very little children, realize that they are indeed not white. And they realize, strangely enough, that I am. And they understand the difference. And when you don't talk to your children, and when you pretend that there isn't racism, or when you pretend that society is past that, you're doing two things. Well, three. You are not telling your kids the truth. And you're not telling yourself the truth. You are, in fact, dismissing and belittling in some way, without intent, right? Because we all want to do this the right way. The person who walks into the room knowing that they're the only black person in the room, right? And then the third piece is you're not opening the conversation for things to be different. And so I like to, and I usually use these examples when people are in the room who don't know my children. So for those who don't, this will really work for you. And for those who do, you'll be like, yeah, I've heard this. When I was going through the adoption process, and I'm a single mom, and I was a single mom when I was adopted, adopting both girls. Mati sort of came along in the middle of all this, stumbled in, as we like to say, that he stumbled in. He didn't realize what he was stumbling into. And in the last 2 weeks, really has questioned his life choices. These are the things that have happened to my kids. When I was adopting, I was told, oh, children don't recognize race until about age 7. That's not true. At least it's not true for my 2 kids, and, you know, they're no different than your kids, right? So when Naomi, who we've talked about, was 4 in preschool, there was a little boy who asked her why she was brown. And she, you know, sort of being Naomi, even at age 4, was like, God made me this way. Do you have a problem? And so we, like the parents that we are, marched ourselves into our little Montessori preschool and had a conversation with the adults and said, listen, this happened, and we're okay with it happening. We recognize the fact that a 4-year-old little boy doesn't know what he's doing, but she is now annoyed and frustrated and now feels different and doesn't want to go to school because these people are pointing out her differences. And what the adults in the room said was, you and your partner should go to a transracial class, a transracial family class, where we can teach you how to be transracial. And I explained to them, strangely enough, we are actually transracial, and we actually do that every day, and it is our life. And we actually get that. However, the other 20 kids in the class, whether or not they are white or brown or some combination of the spectrum, chances are, you know, they don't know this. And the parent of the small child who asked my daughter why she was brown might like the opportunity to explain to her child why that might not be the greatest question, or for that matter, why she's brown. Because it's not my 4-year-old's responsibility to teach your 4-year-old the difference between being born white or any other color, right? And they were like, no, we can't do that. And part of the reason why they felt they couldn't do that is because the parents wouldn't necessarily want to hear it. And so that goes back to my beginning where I say thank you for being here to hear it, right? Because if we're not willing to have difficult conversations, my children's children will be going to school and a 4-year-old will ask them why they're brown, right? So we moved on to first grade at a school sort of, I don't know, behind my head around right there, which as the parents and grandparents of people who send their kids to Alexandria City Schools and to the very good school that is George Mason, you wouldn't expect that when my first grader sat down at her desk that the boy across from her would say, I can't sit next to you because I'm allergic to brown people. But in first grade, my very happy, not Naomi, my very happy other child suddenly came home and said she didn't want to go back to school because the boy at her table was mean to her and said he was allergic to her. And so I marched myself back into school and sat down with the then principal and said, like, what are we going to do about this, right? Which is sort of, I walk into the school at this point, they just kind of roll, well, especially after the last 2 weeks, and they really want to roll their eyes at me, but they have for years. Because what I have found is, as a white woman who raises 2 children, I get outraged, right? I'm outraged. How could somebody say they're allergic to my child? And in having conversations with plenty of brown parents, what I've come to learn, including the guy I go home to every night, is that they're just sort of, this is part of their world. And so there are some things worth having the conversation about, and there are some things that you sort of just roll your eyes at and go about your day. And I don't know how you guys feel about that, but I would have to assume that you share my outrage, right? I mean, that it is outrageous for a 1-year-old to be taught that they are allergic to somebody because of the color of their skin, right? And so even in the best of intentions, let's get to age 7, where the school is teaching in February, right? February, as they do, African American History Month. That's the month. You get to talk about black people during the month of February. Not May. Definitely not January. But for the month of February, you get anything that has to do with black history in this country, which there seems to be a little bit of, right? And in that, in the context of teaching about Martin Luther King and segregation, when you're the only black kid in the room, as Naomi likes to say, everybody starts talking about slaves and then the whole room is looking at me. She's from Ethiopia. No history of slavery in her family. But she's brown, and that's what happens. And in having this conversation, this is sort of such a pervasive thing that, and as many of you know, the almost half the school next door is Hispanic. A little Hispanic boy turned to her and said, well, you shouldn't be going to school here. Like, you should be going to a black school. She's like, you're brown. But that is how we teach our kids. In the 1 month that we teach them about slavery, about black achievement, we're talking about segregation and slavery, and not about Ursula Burns and Ken Frazier, and we're not talking about the CEOs and the achievement and the discoveries of black Americans. We're talking about slavery, we're talking about segregation, we're talking about a very significant piece of American history that is also very myopic in how we then view black people. So it is not surprising, and she was actually a rarity for her, not insulted. She was just sort of like, what are you talking about? And then we go to age 9, and this is a little more significant, right? Because as kids get older and you don't teach them anything, the conversation gets uglier, right? So they were playing in an after-school game in a like their STEM class, right, left school activity. And one of the boys said, well, I'm going to be the king. And before Naomi could say anything, a little boy turned to her and said, well, you'll have to be the slave. And she said, and the other boy jumped to her, leapt to her defense and said, dude, that's kind of racist. And he said, well, okay, then she could be the beggar. And at 9, you then have to wonder, they're not 5, they're not 4 asking why you're brown. They're 9 saying, you see black people as either poor or slaves. And that's 9 years of your life that no one had a conversation with you. That's 9 years of your life that your family, your community, didn't mirror to you anything other than blacks are poor or blacks are slaves. We'll throw in, because we're adults here, or blacks are criminals, right? And then it gets to age 10. And most especially Naomi, but when we had our dinner table conversations, I was like, well, this happens to me too, which is the hair touching. I can touch your hair because it's different. And I can touch your hair because it's there and I want to, and you can't make me stop. And that conversation this year was difficult because it was with friends, right? And here's what I've really come to learn about that piece. You, as an adult, and I can't tell you how many adults have touched my children's hair, nobody ever touches my hair. And it's funny, for those who know me well, this is not my normal hair. I have big hair, but nobody touches my hair. People always touch their hair. And to the point where I like have to tell people to stop in public, like, shopkeeper, can you not touch my child? Because she doesn't like it. Because you wouldn't like it, right? And when Naomi, who we've talked about a lot this morning, and who I usually don't talk about by name, but I will, can stand up and say, black women shouldn't be objectified. It's because when people chase her around the schoolyard just to touch her hair, she feels objectified. She feels like she does not have equal standing with her fifth grade peers because she can't get them to stop touching her hair. And I talk to the parents involved. Sometimes when you talk to the parents, you have conversations where they say, no, my child wouldn't say that. Child of the beggar, slave kid. And then you have conversations with parents who you know are like all of you and are like me. Our intentions are really good, and we think we're raising kids who are aware, and we think that our kids would never be insensitive because we don't want them to be insensitive. And in both cases, two different girls, in both cases, the parents I knew were horrified. And the only thing I had to say to them was, you understand the cultural ramifications of your child not stopping touching my daughter's hair. And they did. And then they had no choice but to sit down and have those conversations with their daughter. And their daughter, strangely enough, have not touched her hair since. But if we're not having those conversations, if we're not saying to our children, just like you wouldn't go up and touch somebody's lips because you think they're pretty, you also don't touch their hair. And if you do that to a brown girl, she thinks you think less of her, not more than her. It's not like Naomi thinks that these girls who touch her hair, or Sarah, these people who touch her hair are doing it because they think it's pretty. They truly think, as does every African-American woman I have ever spoken to, and I have spoken to many about this subject, some we know well, every one of them says, no, it's diminishing. It makes me feel less than. I don't care how nice you think I could manage to wrangle my messy hair. It's diminishing. But if we don't tell our kids that, they don't know. You know, I know that that these girls who chased my daughter around the playground thought that they were giving her some sort of backhanded compliment. You have pretty hair and I want to touch it. I can't stop touching it. It's so great, right? And her response, which I now use, is, I think your lips are great, but I don't touch them. Right? We have to talk to our children differently. And then the Jews don't look like you thing I just had to throw in for good measure. Because that just happened like in November, right? December, right? Because not every black person lives in a slum. Not every black person has a criminal in their family. Not every black person has only gone to college on scholarship. And not every black person's a Baptist. Right? And so my daughter, who there's some very religious Jews in her class, and she was discussing her upcoming bat mitzvah, and I'm not going to lie, it might have been the same kid who said that she could be a beggar and slave, said to her, well, you don't look like a Jew. Which we can go into a whole Jewish conversation about what Jews look like, but we won't. And we'll just say that her reaction was, of course I look like a Jew. What color do you think Jesus was, right? That's her answer to that, right? But it starts the conversation. It continues the conversation of how we're talking to our kids about race. And ultimately what it comes down to, it's not really what we say, it's what we do, right? I had this conversation, Amy came to it with a group of 8 people recently, and I said something that really surprised one of the mothers. I said, "Is where do your children see people of color?" And when I was adopting, they made you take this online test, which I found to be really, really annoying, but really helped me as I was formulating this conversation, because it was like you dragged and clicked where you saw somebody of color. Was it at the bank? Was it at the grocery store? Was it on your bookshelf? And what it made me do was look around my own home before I had my daughters walk into it or crawl into it. It had me notice, what art do I have hanging on my wall? What music do I play? What books do I read? What movies do I see? Who comes for dinner? And I needed to look at my own life and say, if I'm going to raise 2 Ethiopian girls, at the time 1 Ethiopian girl, in my house, what do I have to add to my house? And what do I have to take out of my house? And what difficult conversations do I have to have? Conversations with friends and colleagues where I literally had to say, you can never say that again. Because if you say that again, it's not that I won't speak to you, because I won't. But it's also, you'll never have any exposure to my family because I won't allow you to make racist comments anywhere near my children. People who I love. Right? It's because anytime there's a joke or anytime there's a stereotype, if I don't say something, who's going to protect my children? And so you're all here today, maybe in part because you like me. I'll give you the credit. Or because you're interested in the subject. But our job as humans is to build community. And in order to build community, we have to be inclusive. And to be inclusive, we can't tolerate the slights. Because if we do, we open the door to bigger slights. And that's what I learned when I was bringing Naomi home for the first time, was that I had to say no to people who I cared about. And then I had to really say yes to things I didn't know about. You know, Naomi's from Ethiopia, so the easy conversation is to say, I had to eat Ethiopian food. Because if I didn't eat Ethiopian food, she would never eat Ethiopian food, and she'd lose that part of her culture, right? It's one thing for me to eat Ethiopian food and to bring it to her. It's another thing for us to celebrate Ethiopian holidays or for her to know them, right? I'm a nice Jewish girl from Long Island. And my girls were raised Jewish, but we still celebrate the Epiphany, Timkat, and today is actually Fasica, which is Ethiopian Easter. And so we don't celebrate and go to church for all those things, but they certainly know them, right? And in thinking about that, that's my responsibility, right? If I'm going to adopt children from a different culture, it's my responsibility to know their culture. But then I ask myself, isn't it my responsibility to know the culture of my community? And isn't it my responsibility to know the culture of the people around me and other people in general? Doesn't that make my humanity wider? And so when you want to talk to your children or your grandchildren about race, if you're in a house that is surrounded by all things white, it's harder to do. And so I'll go back to the conversation I said to this woman who has a son my daughter's age, my younger daughter's age, where does your son see black people? And she's like, well, you know, he plays baseball and all his favorite baseball players, and, you know, we go to Redskin games and they're all. And I said, yes, and that's why your son will be raised to believe that black people can be good athletes. Right? If you mirror something different at home than your kids, and this is true, you know this, right? This is stuff you know about religion. If you don't have religion in your household, your kids aren't going to grow up religious. And if you don't have good manners in your household, your kids are not going to have good table manners at somebody else's house, right? And this is no different. If you don't have it in your house, then your children don't have it in their lives. And it goes for the same thing as who's sitting around your kitchen table. You can say all day long, I work with a diverse group of people. But are they your friends? Are they your family members? Do you bring them into your home? Is your child exposed to them? Or is your child only exposed to the people of color who provide you a service? Because then in their mind, people of color provide you service. Right? If you're not sitting across the dinner table from somebody who is your friend, your family member, then they don't know that. It's not what they experience. If your child has an African-American friend and you don't invite them over to play, then they don't know it's okay. And then, of course, who's in your community? And that's not always easy, right? We live in a kind of diverse community here. You know, I mean, so as we mentioned a little bit about Naomi, and she went and spoke at the March for Our Lives last weekend, and she had, like, a big crisis in writing her speech. Not that she isn't dramatic to begin with in 11, so writing the speech was going to be a big drama. But she sat down with me, and she was really upset. She said, I can't talk about Parkland. I didn't go to school where there was a shooting in our school. And I can't talk about being a black kid who walks through bullet-riddled streets to get to school in the morning. That's not who I am. I live two blocks from here, right? And so we talked about telling her story and about what all of the previous screen has meant to her. And we talked about her community. And we talked about shootings that happened here, right? And we talked about the SWAT team on their elementary school lawn. And we talked about the shooting on the baseball field. where all her friends play, where your son, right, plays Little League. And that's her world, right? That's her community. And so it gave her context, and she was able to get up, she was able to write and then get up and deliver this crazy speech that she did that's gotten her this incredible amount of recognition because she could write a speech about her community. She could write a speech about who she is in her community and bring in all that context. And that's what our kids need to do every day. They need to have context. And so if their context is, I go to a church that is mostly white and I don't sit next to the people of color who are in my church and I don't know who they are, right? They might be there, but I don't really know them. And I go to school, and people, listen, people self-segregate, and that's a normal thing. But we've been having this conversation amongst the parents who have grown so close over the last couple of weeks at George Mason, watching our kids do incredible things. How do we get the Hispanic kids to sit with the white kids? We have, except for the one white kid who sits with the Hispanic kids, right? How do you get people to intermingle? And if you don't proactively do it, trust me, no one will. If you didn't proactively walk in the door this morning to have this conversation, the venue to have this conversation is small, right? That you're not necessarily going to go home and have this conversation at your table unless if there's a reason to. It is very comfortable not having this conversation. But I urge you to look at my experience and realize that when you do add context to your child's life, they can get up, to everyone's surprise and your own as well, and be able to deliver a speech that gets her on Ellen, right? That all your kids can do that, your grandchildren, your neighbors, yourself. That when you add context to your community, when you go out and not just serve food at a food bank, but get to know the guy who runs the food bank, get to know the lawyer and the doctor and show that to your child too, then they have context, right? Then they have a place to go from. And again, on the cultural reference side of things, you know, we spend a lot of time in bookstores looking for African-American authors for young adult books because while I like my kids to read the books that I read growing up, I didn't read one black author growing up. I don't think there was one for me to have access to, right? But they do, and so we do. And music is easy. For us, Ethiopian music is really where our stretch is. It's not just, it's easy to listen to African-American music. But it's also important to, as you're listening to African-American music, as you're engaging in culture that you're so used to that you don't think of it as being African-American, right? I mean, you don't necessarily think of, you know, the songs you play on your radio or your iPad when you go running, or iPod, I suppose, when you go running, are really deeply cultural to a segment of society. They're just the music you listen to. Stopping for a moment to have those conversations with your children or your grandchildren makes it accessible to them in a different way, right? You know, again, my kids will come to me and say, why does that white woman wear dreadlocks? You know, they're big on cultural appropriation these days. And the conversation in our household of whether or not, you know, as I have said recently, you want your kids to be smart until it's 8 a.m. and they want to talk about race. And they want to talk about the difference between cultural appreciation and cultural appropriation, and you're like, really? I don't know, maybe she just had bad hair that day. This is my answer always. But to even know to have those conversations is why, if truth be known, and she's here so I can say this, while Naomi went to her classmates and said, I think that we should add a minute into our walkout because of Cortland Arrington, a black girl who was killed since Parkland in Alabama, she went there on the same day with a white boy who lives diagonally across the street from her, whose mother's here right now, who doesn't go to this church. And he came in and said, guys, I think we should add a minute to our walkout because of this black woman who was killed. And, you know, black women never get recognition. And he's a young 11-year-old white kid, right? And that's because he lives in a household where that's a conversation that's had at dinner, right? When people say about Naomi, how could you give this speech at 11? Because I've heard that speech at dinner countless times of why do they identify black people as black on the news but they don't identify white people? Why are we talking about JonBenet Ramsey still 25 years later but we don't talk about the woman, the young girl from the homeless shelter who was who's been missing for 2 years? These are the conversations that our kids have because they have them at the dinner table. And if you don't, then they won't. And things won't be much different. And so, what to do, right? And if you're here, you're at least curious as to what should be different. And the first answer is, be curious, right? I'm not kidding, and I'll skip to it. I'm not kidding when I say it is remarkably difficult to fill a room full of white folks to talk about race. We are taught throughout our lives not to talk about it. We're taught throughout our lives to say, oh, you're separate but equal, right? You're different, but you're equal to me. And being here today is a step for everyone, and I thank you of recognition that that's just not sort of how it is, right? That there is inequality. There doesn't need to be. There isn't always. But there is. And if we don't acknowledge that people are different, we can't deal with how to make them have equal opportunity. If we don't look at a child and say, you know, and we see this all the time at George Mason, right? It's a bust school from kids from projects who are brown. And almost universally, I stand and pick up my daughter and watch all the kids come out and get on the bus. And I am not kidding when I say to you there is one white child who gets on a bus in the afternoon, and she only gets on the bus because she's going to her mother who teaches at a different school. And so the conversation that I have with my daughter of why do the kids who get bused have breakfast at school? Why can't I have breakfast at school? She wants to know. But we can't go about changing anything unless if we have a conversation, say, yeah, they get bused here, and they get bused here, and they live in lower income housing in Alexandria, and they come here, and they don't have the same opportunity and the same privilege as you do. And so we're all here today relinquishing a bit of our privilege to say we want to be open to having these conversations. We want to be a better advocate and be a better ally for the person sitting next to me or the person sitting next to my daughter or son or my grandchild. And so that is, in and of itself, something to take away from this, to continue this conversation with other people, to have the ability to say, yeah, what's it like for you? You know, it's been a weird place for me because I have felt that I've needed to reach out in the last couple of weeks to every African-American female I know to make sure that when my daughter gets up and gives a speech in front of a million people, she's not saying something that is offensive. Because I think I know, but I don't really know. And so the night before she gave the speech, the night she wrote the speech, I called a friend of mine. I said, I know this is, like, really weird, and I kind of feel awkward asking you, but you're black and I'm not. I'm going to ask you. I want to read you something that she wrote, and can you tell me if you find it offensive? Because I just don't know. And I read it, and she's like, it's not that I find it offensive. It's that I find that you need to change these words. Tell her, put her on the phone with me. And so she talked to her, and she told her why she thought this line in her speech wasn't offensive. It was just, it fed into a stereotype. It fed into the stereotype that women often need to apologize. So Naomi was going to apologize for something in her speech. And she's like, don't you apologize. You're asked to apologize for being black. You're asked to apologize for being a woman all too often. Just acknowledge it. Say, this is what it is, whether you like it or not. And it was a very powerful line in her speech when she did it. But I was horrified. And I've gone back to this woman a couple of times because I need cultural references. We've gotten inundated with press calls, and I don't know which is the appropriate media outlet to talk to, which is good, which is bad. And she's a media person. She happens to be African-American. It's worked out quite well for me. And she's been generous about it, right? But I'm curious. I don't know. I know I'm not, even though I raised two black kids and I live with a black man, I am not. And so what I know for sure is, though, when I come here and I speak to a room that is mostly white, that it is easier for you guys to listen and to hear from me than if I was a black woman doing it. And I've said it before, I have lots of friends who coach and give workshops and who are African-American women, and I've talked to them about it too. Am I an authentic voice for this conversation? No, because I'm white. Am I more authentic because I raise black kids and I live in this sort of, I straddle worlds? Sure. Is it more comfortable hearing from me for all of you? I think so. I think it would be for me, right? I am not, I have my own biases. We all do. And I know I would be more comfortable, just as I am less comfortable when I call an African-American woman and say, so this is what's going on with Naomi and her hair. Am I crazy? And they're like, no, you're not crazy, right? Or, you know, what do you think about this? Well, I think you're overreacting, right? I have people I touch base with because I know I don't know, right? And there's nothing, there's no shame in that. There's a reality to that. And so I'd ask all of you to say, I need to be more curious. I need to talk to the people I know. And I would also say this. Part of the reason why I think these talks are important is because I'm a white woman talking to white people about race. And it's not a black person's job to teach you. It's our job to teach each other and to use people as references, certainly, and to ask questions and to be curious. But it is not anyone's job but my own to teach me how to do this. And it is my job to teach my community. So that is sort of why I asked you all here today and why I do this and what I think you can take away from it. But I would really like to start a conversation in the time that we have left and see what you... Yes.
I just wanted to thank you for bringing this up. I have two adopted children myself. My son is from Guatemala, so Hispanic. And we have the same thing at school where kids, ironically, African-American kids come up and say, that's your mom. You know, so... Happily, I've had him since a baby, so he doesn't have any issues, and my daughter's from Russia, so she's white and ironically looks like me, but I got her at age 7, so she feels different in a profound sense that we had to actually, you know, explore with therapists, a profound sense where he doesn't, so it's kind of ironic that it's
right.
Also a different dynamic, but I wanted to share with my son when he was 4, as I'm getting ready in the morning to go to work, he comes in and he's very upset, he said, Mom, is it true that you and I aren't And I was like, a heads up from the daycare would have been nice that you were going to have this conversation. So I could have had a cup of coffee before I had to start into that. But I'm like, yeah, that's true. You know you're adopted. And I said, let's look at our arms. And yeah, you're darker than I am, and does this matter? And he was upset. And I said, well, you look more like Poppy. And I was like, thank God. At that point, my future husband is Hispanic, too, from Peru. So he was like, oh, I look like Poppy. And then he's like, I didn't come out of the thin air. I'm connected to people that I love. In a way that he wasn't feeling connected to me, and then he was okay with it. So I shared with the daycare later in the same sense that when we had his first Father's Day celebration and I was a single parent, I said, let's just be aware that there are people who don't have a father, and he came home from that at age 2. He says, do I have a dad? And I had to have this conversation about there are men in your life, so he used to call my dad Grandpa Dad, Dad Grandpa, you know, because I call him Dad, you know, so he was like, I have Dad Grandpa. You know, but it's like, I think we're unaware of these things, and people look at me, and I'm white, and they don't think
right.
anything of this. And my husband, who's from Peru, came back from a trip to the, you know, after all this craziness started, and at the airport in Dulles, the customs immigration officer said, you know, we're getting rid of people like you.
Yeah.
And I was like, I said, I want the name of that person, I want their supervisor, we are going tomorrow morning, we're having this conversation. I was like, how dare he to speak to you like that? But, you know, I don't see this in my life because I'm white, so my privilege just rolls forward. But I just want to say, like, there is so much of this out there that we don't even realize.
Right.
So I'm glad we're having this conversation. I also want to thank everybody because sometimes you know, you really feel like you're the only one dealing with this stuff, and I really appreciate that everybody's open.
Well, I mean, and that's the couple things. That's the great thing, right, that you're all here and you're all mostly white, right? And you get to use your privilege like that, too. Like, I'm for those who know me, this is no surprise that I like to be outraged, right? Because I know it's easy for me to walk in and to be difficult for the administration of the school when I don't think they're handling something that has occurred with my child. it is easy for me to use my outrage. It is very difficult for the Hispanic mother, who we've always discussed is busing her kid from Orlandria, who doesn't speak English, who works three jobs, who has to worry about their legal status, walking into the school and having that conversation. It's impossible. And I know for sure that my child is not the only child who has had racial conversations with other kids, inappropriate conversations, I would say, that all those kids do too. And if I, with all my vast amount of privilege and ability to go from my office a mile away to my house two blocks away to school, can't do that, then who can? And so that's part of what I hope each of you take here, that it is so easy for you to do this. It is so much harder the darker the pigment of your skin. And you're so, you know, sometimes Monty, who's my partner, says to me, okay, you need to stop now. You're making me crazy. Matter of fact, he maybe says that a lot. But what he says, I remember being really upset because my daughter informed me one day in preschool that she wanted to be white, and I, like, because all the Disney princesses were white, and just then, it was just then that Tiana was coming out. And he said, listen, you know, what do you think my sister felt? What do you think the conversations were like with my mother and my sister growing up? He's like, deal with it. Right? And so I'm going to use my privilege to be cranky all the time about it. And I'm going to deal with it. Right? My daughter in kindergarten, a very close friend of her told her that I couldn't be her mother. I had to be her stepmother or her nanny. And I, like, would have dealt with that, but she ceased speaking to the child for literally 5 years. This is the first year she has started to re-talk to that child because she's worse than I could ever hope to be. But a year later, her mother said to me, oh, they used to be so close. Why aren't they close now? She feels left out. And I said, well, honestly, I'll tell you, because you really need to have a conversation with your child about race and adoption, because this is what happened. And as much as I've told her, she doesn't mean it. She doesn't know. She's in kindergarten. She doesn't realize. She will not forgive your child. And so I'll work on that with my kid, but you work on this with yours. So, Amy Upton. Well, that reminds me, this year my younger daughter is ADHD and she goes to a private school. And she came home with homework, and it was crazy homework, and it was to help kids with descriptions. And they were describing various scenarios, and they had various people, and I kid you not, they described a robbery, and the guy was black. And the only guy and the only description mentioning color. And I called the school, and I got home, and literally I was met at the door, and everybody was like, it's going to be bad. And it's really bad if, like, Monty's annoyed. It's really bad. He's like, read this. So I read it, and I went to the school, and they were horrified, and they took it from their curriculum, and it's not there anymore. But it was a very progressive. It's a Quaker school, lovely, progressive group of people. But nobody paid attention to that detail. And it's just pervasive. As you said, it's just pervasive. Yeah. Emmy's grandpa.
Our son is married to a Costa Rican who is an American now. But the nice point is that both the son and daughter-in-law have raised the kids very biculturally. They know a great deal about Latin America. They speak Spanish all the time at home and so on. But our grandson, 10, has very long hair by his own choice. And so I'm simply going to point out here that he's gotten an awful lot of teasing and discrimination, particularly from girls riding the bus to the Arlington ATS school, the school there. And at the point where it was really getting to him, and we had to actually, they did, and talk to the teacher in the class and say, listen, because a boy chooses to wear his hair long or does something else, that doesn't mean they're wrong or should ever
right.
be teased. But so my point is simply that there are a lot of things
sure.
that our children may choose or we, the parents, grandparents, may choose to do that will be distinctive and they have to be understood.
Right. Right.
So it's been fascinating to see that this has come down on them. It would be just
well, and it's all about communication, right?
Yeah.
It's about having the conversation with the school. It's about him having the ability and the words to have the conversation with his peers. It's about the parents talking to the parents. It's all of it. And it's about understanding, right? And running on the assumption that everybody's experience is different. And wouldn't it be great to be curious about it? Right.
And white people are not willing to meet where I am. They're really not interested. I don't want to, like, categorize anybody. But, like, when my kids were bringing friends home from school, or making those, or when they were bringing their friends over, they knew. They were to give me a heads up the day before that they were planning to do this. So I could make sure that we were getting spaghetti or something for dinner. Because I knew they weren't interested.
Isn't that so incredibly sad?
And so whenever somebody comes over, I got to make sure that I'm having, like, chocolate chip cookies or something. I know. And so they never ask me. That's the thing. They never ask me, what do you guys eat for dinner? I mean, my kids are interested. One of my kids says, what do white people eat for dinner? I said, I don't know what white people eat for dinner.
Well, then they should go hungry.
Why can't even try it? I mean, can you try it, you know? But I actually have a pastor of a church who heard my son using the racial slur. And it was like, he said, what? He slammed on the brakes, turn around, we go back to the church. And I said, just say that. I said, well, I didn't know it was a racial slur. I said, really? I mean, in the 2000s, you didn't know that.
Well, I think everybody does, right? Right. Right.
Men have sort of a, black men have kind of an image, and black women have sort of an opposite image. And I said, Asian guys never get the girl. They're always, if they're having an ad on TV about cell phones or something, he's the sales guy. He's always an Asian guy. He's not the customer, he's the sales guy.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's a couple of things that you said. One, I think there's a room full of people who would want to come over to your house and eat what you cook. I'm one of them. And then I would go on to say that these stereotypes are pervasive everywhere. And it's not, I mean, it's not, I'm happy to stay because I know you're looking at me like we're done here.
Well, no, I just finished, and I would invite people to stay if they would like to stay and ask some questions.
I am happily here.
But next week, I want to remind people we have two incredible classes at the same time, which I apologize for, but Julie will be back to take us deeper and to look at some of these issues that we're bubbled up here today. And we will also have a woman who's here to talk about nutrition, and some of the latest research in nutrition will be downstairs in the Westminster. So please share that information with others, and let's give Julie a hand for the panel.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to stay if anybody...